There's all sorts of ways that I think in some ways EVs and software have been brilliant, but then when you overplay them, I think you absolutely overwhelmed. You lose a little bit of character and you lose a lot of the magic, which I think we want to do. So I think turning some things off is also going to be one of our key elements.
Hello. Welcome to the Autonicast. This is Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
And I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors.
And I'm Alex Roy, the founder of the Human Driving Association and principal at Johnson & Roy, the finest, most insightful, and humble advisory and consulting firm in transportation. Super excited today because one of my favorite brands always was the Scout, the International Harbinger Scout. I craved one. And today, our guest is Scott Keogh, the former president of Audi North America and the CEO of Scout in its new incarnation, who is going to explain to us how he's going to take this brand and deliver it unto the 21st century. Welcome, Scott Keogh.
Well, that was a very humble setup, Alex. Absolute pleasure to be here. Thanks, everybody.
Tell us about how and why you decided to leave your role as president of Audi North America, which is, well, that's pretty cool, to do this and what you intend to do with the Scout brand.
Well, we tend to do great things for sure. I think the how is the first part. Look, I think a couple of things. I think in parallel, of course, I had my Audi responsibility and, of course, at the time was responsible for the Volkswagen Group. Of course, that included factories in Mexico and, of course, factory in Chattanooga. And at the time, the Volkswagen Group back in Germany sort of took a global assessment. And assessment number one was they wanted to be a globally strong brand in all three major regions. This, of course, is China and Asia, Europe and North America. When they looked at China, they have nearly 20 points of market share with all of their brands. Look at Europe, nearly 20 points of market share with all the brands. And America, somewhere to a tune of 4 to 5 points of market share with Volkswagen, Audi and Porsche. So the question on the table was, what could we do to expand in the North American region, particularly with everything with geopolitics and, of course, America being a key region. So one of the ideas on the table, and it was, you know, pretty straightforward logic that says, here are the profit pools in the North American market. They sit in pickup trucks. They sit in these rugged SUVs. About 40% of the profits come from that. Of course, we have this magical moment right now with everything happening with EVs. And of course, this could be an opportunity to attack these profit pools with an American icon resurrected and brought back to life, with a clean slate of how we structure the company and everything. And then, of course, the backing of the Volkswagen Group. So the idea was put on the table. And, you know, one of the things to help put on the table is, of course, the acquisition of Navistar. And Navistar held the rights, of course, to the Scout trademark. And from that acquisition, of course, in parallel the strategy, this came to life. So your next question was, why did I do it? And in my mind, I view this nothing more than the chance of a lifetime. I think you have the three pieces in place. One, you have Scout, iconic American brand to bring it back to life. The second thing, you have the backing of the Volkswagen Group, which of course helps with terms of trade with suppliers, helps with cost, helps with industrialization. And the third thing, an absolute clean slate opportunity. We've registered the company in Delaware. We've registered the company as an independent American operation, which allows us to look at things like IT infrastructure and legacy cost and all of the strategies that we have with a clean slate. I think, as you know, large corporations also take on big legacy costs. They take on a lot of scar tissue. And to start with a clean slate at this time was huge. So that's why I'm here. That's why we did it. And it's a portion of why I'm so excited.
So my question is, when the Navistar acquisition happened, I don't know how close that was to what was happening in the background in terms of deciding or coming up with a plan to capture more market share in the United States, if that was close. But I kind of wanted the backstory of, was the Scout name brand International Harvester already sort of on everyone's radar, or was this a discovery that occurred, you know, in those discussions of like, hey, what are we going to do in the U.S. to capture more customers?
Now, it was a little bit of a combination, but I would say more of a discovery. The acquisition of Navistar was done for the heavy truck business, the international truck business, and that's why it was acquired, and it makes total sense. But there was an article, oddly enough, in Automotive News that basically wrote the headline, and the headline said, with the acquisition of Navistar could give the group instant street cred in these profitable segments. And they sort of laid out the scouting. In parallel, at the same time, a lot of these different strategies were being put on the table about how we could grow market share and how we could address it. So it was sort of in parallel, but the acquisition was done for the truck business. A nice coincidence of the acquisition was, of course, the IP for the Scout brand. And the two sort of came together in that window, let's say.
So I mean, you know, there were obviously a number of ways of tackling, right? And there have been a number of attempts at tackling this sort of perennial challenge Volkswagen has had in the U.S. market. And even once you sort of, identified Scout as the opportunity to do that, there were a number of different ways to approach that. And so just for example, right, you have this large plant in Chattanooga where you're already making electric vehicles. It's been a while since I've been there, but it seems like a very big space, lots of room to expand. You could have done this in a way where Scout was another Volkswagen brand, something else that you would see at a Volkswagen dealership, something that was made at Volkswagen's plants. Instead, you're taking this very conscious, different approach to kind of set this up as an independent company, its own manufacturing. I want to talk about the retail side of this later because I'm fascinated by that. But talk us through a little bit about why, what sort of broke that decision the way that you ended up going.
Yeah, I think to me, strategically, it's quite clear. You know, the third piece, as I mentioned, is to start with a clean slate. And so starting with a clean slate was how we registered the company, as I said, in Delaware. Registering the company, of course, opens us up for strategic investors. It opens us up to potentially go to an IPO. It opens up a long runway of different options that we can have. So that was the smart way to go. We wanted to start with a 100% clean slate. I think, as you know, companies, rightly or wrongly, build up a lot of legacy ideas. They build up a lot of legacy costs. They build up a lot of legacy scar tissue. And we wanted to obviously avoid all of that. I think the other thing we very clearly wanted to do, and you'll see it where I am here now in Novi, Michigan, is of course the skill set to build a product for the U.S. market. So of course that entails hiring American engineers. I think if you look at the base of the engineering that we have here, we have a lot of people from Stellantis, from Ford, from Rivian, from Tesla, to give us that skill set in the region. Historically, what we've done, as you know, if we've imported cars, modified those cars to make them for the U.S. market, this is 100% from the product to the factory, to the company, to the hiring, to the independence to make this thing fine-tuned for the U.S. market. So that's why we wanted to take this route and why we did it.
I wanted to follow up on something you said, legacy scar tissue, which is a great term, because VW Group has a lot of legacy scar tissue. There's 675,000 employees. So when you talk about clean slate, it sounds aspirational, but how separate are you? Can you truly operate independently, or do you ultimately have to, you ultimately have to answer to VW Group at some point, right? I mean, how many hands are trying to get, how many VW hands are trying to get into Scout? Or are you able to, at least right now, like sort of keep some distance from them?
Look, I would say, honestly, the relationship has been nearly perfect in many regards. You are absolutely right. A company that has 670,000 employees, has 150 plants, has a global footprint in nearly every country around the world, has an entirely different presence, cost structure than one that is just starting up, full stop. But what we're able to do is actually take the best of the Volkswagen Group, and the best of the Volkswagen Group does an awful lot of things. One, as I said, with a startup, you would never get the terms of trade with suppliers that we're going to be able to get and are be able to get, full stop. So scaling and bundling and all of that is critical to get cost right, material cost and car business. We can do that. If you look at the setup in, of course, Columbia and in South Carolina, we never would have been able to have the pace that we had without having a good understanding of how to lay out a plant, how to structure a plant, how to build a plant. You know, we had to look at 74 sites to get that location. So we have people in the group in Germany who are quite skilled at site management and how to handle all logistics and all of that. And the other piece of the puzzle, of course, is the capital. Of course, that's what the Volkswagen Group is doing, is funding it and, of course, making it happen. So in my mind, it's been a huge asset. Are they giving us enough independence? I would say absolutely 100%. Of course, they're shareholders. They want to be engaged. They want to be involved. They want success. We all do. But the balance, I think, has been quite good.
Let's move on to the fun part, my friends. Let's talk about the first model, or to whatever you can tell us about it. Powertrain, form factor, competitors, differentiator beyond the awesome brand. Let's put that aside. Scout's a great brand. Tell us about the rest of the initial product plan.
No, that's good. I think let's talk at the high level. I think you said the exact same right thing in terms of form factor and its intent and things like that. At the highest levels, you know, what we see in the marketplace with a lot of EVs, and I don't want to get too, you know, sort of, let's say, professorial on this front.
But you should please get professorial. This is the show.
In my mind, I think what's happened with EVs is they've sort of set them up as these sort of, I would say, disconnection machines. It's going to be shaped like a jelly bean. Software will handle everything. You just sit behind a seat and don't worry about anything. And it's going to be this sort of isolation, semi-dystopian experience getting behind the wheel of an EV. And I think what we're trying to do, honestly, is to use the technology. But, you know, the term we're using in here is to build a connection machine. We want this car to connect. There was a time when cars weren't built to isolate you. They were times to connect you to society, connect you to your neighbors, connect you to your family. So I think you'll see features like bench seats and tailgating and everything else that we bring back that sort of 60s connection. I think the second thing that's critical is the form factor. Is it going to be the most hyper aeroed jelly bean car? No. I think to be a Scout, plus to be liked and plus to be loved, we're going to build a car with character. So it's going to have the character of a Scout. And I think the Scout had some really cool stuff. Hyper short front overhang, right? Which is difficult to execute on crash and everything else, but that gives its proportions. Straight up A-pillar as opposed to super hyper raked. Obviously have a little bit more rear overhang to let the car hang off a bit. I think it's important for EVs not to just be hyper optimized range machines. They got to also be loved machines with a really good, strong form factor. I think the second thing, once you get off of that, is form factor, is us. It's important to have credibility of the capabilities of the car. And I think if you looked at Scout back in the day, it was a highly capable machine. I think if people wanted to be cynical, they would say, well, the Volkswagen Group is going to take this icon and, yeah, not make it capable. We feel very confident we're going to make a very, very capable machine in terms of body on frame, in terms of the axle setup, in terms of all that. So our first priority, honestly, is to build a capable, cool car that connects people. Then we take advantage of the technologies, range, software, and all that type of stuff. But it'll be credible, full stop, and I think we're going to offer a clear alternative to, let's say, the other EVs that are out there in terms of its capabilities. I think a good word is a car with character, I think, would be the right thing. Total character.
Scott is so well media trained and so good. He doesn't want to talk about mention another brand. Do one of you guys want to ask a mean question, or should it be me?
Well, I don't know if it's a mean question, but I think production is supposed to start in like late 2026, and I think of the sort of lifestyle brand that you're really aiming for, and I see it, at least in my view, kind of coming up against potentially a Rivian and the R2, which I don't think we have a firm production date for yet. I think maybe 2025, 2026. Is that like a right assessment? Is that sort of probably the prime competitor? And if not, why? Because to me, it just seems like classic lifestyle, you know, outdoorsy.
I would say no, but a little bit of yes, just to be provocative. I think, look, the right brand of vehicle that we're looking for is, look, I think products come down to two sort of things. There's everyday, mainstream, nice kind of vehicles, and they sell an awful lot of them. American buy tons of them, and fantastic. And then there's these cars, trucks that become sort of tribal. Real tribes and communities get behind them. And I think in that camp, it's much more at the high end, Defender types of vehicles, Bronco types of vehicles, maybe pieces of Wrangler, somewhere in there where you build a car with truck, with character, real community, real tribe, as opposed to mainstream. I think the Rivian is a great machine. I do. I wouldn't call it more of this tribal character kind of machine, which we'll build. Our car is going to be more rugged. It's going to be a little bit more, let's say, can do versus delicate and nice.
Got it.
So So this is an interesting. I sense a little bit of tension here, right? Because right, so you
no tension. Number, all love,
no, no,
all
no, no,
here.
No, 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 no,
okay.
No.
Tension is accepted.
You, do I look tense?
No. I want to explore attention in a couple of things you said. What, right? So these kinds of vehicles, right? And there's a number of examples of. You know, Wranglers and I think the Bronco, I think you've said, is an example of like the kind of vehicle that really has come out more recently and been able to show, you know, how passionate people can be about that. What's interesting though is, and where the tension is I wonder, you know, those vehicles are often, they're great businesses to be in because they're high margin, right? And I think especially if you think about a startup, you know, you need to get those margins kind of from day one as much as possible. We've seen how hard that can be for a lot of the new players in the space. But then at the strategic level, the goal is to grow volume, right? To grow overall market share in the US. Now, obviously, we're talking short-term, you know, strategy tactics versus sort of long-term goals. But I'm wondering how that's where I see the tension, right? And I'm wondering how you think about sort of the approach that you're taking versus the long-term goals, how those mesh sort of over the long term in your mind.
Super smart question. So I'm with you. I don't see this space as, let's say, being a niche small space. I think it's quite a big space and has a lot of, let's say, derivatives and options behind it. So to go to Alex's question and then come back to you, the two vehicles that we've announced and we will be launching is, first and foremost, we will be launching what we call an RUV, a rugged utility vehicle, which I've just been talking about. Off that same platform, we will also be launching a pickup truck as well. Same characters, same idea, same everything. So in my mind, the volume opportunity looking at America is definitely there. The profit opportunity is there. I think more importantly, you see this segment absolutely exploding because people just don't want to drive another mainstream kind of vehicle. And you see it with the movement to national parks. You see it with the success, honestly, of these vehicles. You see Toyota getting back into and reviving this segment with a fair amount of success. And I think Americans are looking for these in their driveways. I think the other thing that's critical for us and why we wanted to go with the Scout brand is exactly to get that credibility. You know, when we took a look at, let's say, what are powerful, iconic, global American brands, in my mind, they tend to fall into two camps. I'm simplifying it, of course. Camp number one is, let's call it great Americana. And I would put like Levi's in that kind of camp. And you could wear a pair of Levi's to Nobu in Malibu. You can wear it on a work site and it's universally accepted. Great pair of jeans. The second camp, I would say, is the tech firms. And I don't know, let's put Apple in that camp and a smart global tech firm. So, you know, the space we're looking for is exactly that. We think we can have this classic American character from the heartland, which we will do with Scout. And then, of course, smart use of technology. We don't want to overwhelm with technology. I think that's been the story of a lot of software. There's more telling you what's going wrong. There's more pangs of anxiety being blasted with software alerts, as opposed to a lot of mechanical things in the car work quite well. We don't need to reinvent every single aspect with software. And so I think there's ways we can be smart. I think there's trends towards, honestly, detoxing from screens. I don't think you need a screen across the entire pillar to pillar. I don't think you need a screen in the rear for every conceivable passenger. I don't think you need a screen in the ceiling. So there's all sorts of ways that I think in some ways EVs and software have been brilliant. But then when you overplay them, I think you absolutely overwhelmed. You lose a little bit of character and you lose a lot of the magic, which I think we want to do. So I think turning some things off is also going to be one of our key elements, which of course we could get to. But no, I think there's room big time for volume here.
All right. So years ago, I got into, what was the Aston Martin four-door that came out? That was
the Rapide.
Oh, the Rapide.
So beautiful.
Once you got in, you didn't, but you didn't get back out of the thing once you got in.
And no one wanted to get in twice, like, ever. And so, but nothing is more ego-wilting than the infotainment system on
the old Daimler infotainment system.
And so, look, no one is gonna. I've never met a person who said, oh my God, I just came out of a VW ID4. That infotainment was the greatest thing ever. Everyone else should close doors and just go home. So everything you've said resonates with me. Is the infotainment going to be straight out of a VW? Is it going to be reskinned from the VW UI UX, or are you going to do something in infotainment that matches the rest of what you're doing with the brand?
I think your final thought, I don't think, I know your final thought is exactly what we want to do and will do. I think, as you know, Alex, you can't launch a brand like this and not connect and glue everything together 100%. I think one of the things about the automotive business, you know, it leads to this dislocation. Your app is one thing. A supplier did the UX. You leave the car, you get in the car, and the ecosystem is all over the place. We're sort of fanatical about one ecosystem. So the UX is going to match our CI/CD. The simplified UX is going to match the brand proposition. It's going to match what's on the app. It's going to match on the website. So it's something we're doing a lot of work now, but it's one of the things you can do as a startup because you're not inheriting everything. You're not inheriting all the legacy IT systems and on and on. So the answer is yes, super hard to do, but 100% that's what we're going to do.
So I imagine everybody wants to know, like, what kind of batteries can we expect to see? And what charging connection do you plan to use? And then, of course, Rivian has the Adventure Network. And Rivian and others like Ford have developed, and Jeep, developed actual ecosystems around the community. There's off-road schools. There's off-road events. Walk us through battery, through the community events, and charging.
So look, battery, we're not ready to announce anything as of this time. Of course, as you look at it, comes down to relatively simple things. It comes down to form factor, it comes down to chemistry, and then of course at the site we'll be doing our own battery assembly. Nothing to announce at this time. What I think you're going to have, and I know you're going to have, is, look, the name of the game is finding this balance, the balance between cost and of course getting the right range. And I think what you're seeing a lot of is gigantic, gigantic batteries. And of course, you start to play with a brutal physics game. Yeah, the bigger the battery, the more weight of the car, and the physics circles the wrong way. So I think there is a smart balance, one we need to strike to get the cost and the range right, because that's the axis that you need to drive there. I think we'll get it right. I'll look to that. But of course, we have nothing to announce in terms of form factor, in terms of chemistry. What I do see, though, and I don't think this is being reported enough in many regards, is certainly we understand the cost situation. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But if you look at where battery pricing is going, it's 100% heading in the right direction. It's where a lot of people projected, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. And so costs are going down and we're seeing good opportunities there. In terms of charging, we will be 100% since the vehicle won't be coming, as you said, late 26, early 27 with the NACS. So that will be the standard on all Scouts. By the way, I think that's one of the critical things, is to have a common ecosystem. I think one of the things that hurts EVs is having a disconnected ecosystem. So I think that will certainly help. And in terms of, as you're saying, let's say the Scout community, nothing to announce now, but 100%, we're already doing a little bit of it right now. As you know, we just had our factory groundbreaking. We had a lot of Scout community members down there. They drove the old vehicles. So certainly we will keep that alive through events, through off-road, through driving, all that. But it's still early days. We're more focused on, like, let's build a great car, and then we'll cross that bridge when we get there, 100%, Alex.
One more quick follow-up question. There are people who buy their Jeeps or Broncos or whatever, and they keep them a long time. It's a subset of the owners, but they exist. With an EV, off-road vehicle, a long time means battery degradation over time. You're also using it under extreme conditions. Is there going to be any kind of battery built into the business model, a battery replacement or swap or discount? Is there some long-term ownership method for an owner not to take a bath on these things after X number of years?
Yeah, the answer is we don't have a swap situation, let's say 12 years down the road, whatever it may be. But I would say on two fronts. One, we're going to warranty the car and look after the car. The second thing, we're going to be transparent. I think that's what this demands in terms of, you say, degradation. Now, if you look at the facts from what we see from some of these cars that have been on the road a relatively long time now, the degradation has not, frankly, been that severe at all in many regards. So I think I don't want to say it's overhyped. That's too strong a word, but the degradation has been quite minimal. To me, it's much more about transparency and understanding versus unknown. But no, we don't intend to have a battery swap, I don't know, after 10, 12 years of ownership. What we do intend to do is have a good battery with a really good warranty and good transparency on what you can expect in terms of degradation, all that.
Chris, I know you want to get in. I just wanted to, I have a question about the sort of the UX piece though. And just before we get too much further down the road,
I just want to
just touch on that really quick, because I think it's really interesting. I've seen some of the things that you and other members of the Scout team have spoken about, you know, this desire for physical buttons and controls inside the vehicle. And this is something, you know, that I like struggle with, is like, how much of a curmudgeon am I that, like, you know, I'm frustrated by, you know, everything being on screens. I like it, but it feels like, right, like there's such a differentiation challenge in the auto industry that, and this is such an obvious way to differentiate that, like, if this were a really viable strategy, wouldn't someone have done it more by now, right? Like what? So I'm kind of curious, like, what are the, you know, what allows Scout to do it? I mean, I understand maybe the heritage might be part of it, but, like, are there concerns that you could go too far in getting away from screens and people feeling like, hey, this vehicle isn't as high tech as what I expect, and I'm not gonna, like talk a little bit about that balance that you have to strike there, right?
No, it's a good question. I think first and foremost, to be super blunt, like, no. You know, I haven't heard anyone in all focus groups and all clinics, and I'd love to talk about that for a second, that says, oh my God, I need another screen. I'm going crazy here. I need more screens. And I definitely haven't heard anyone say, I want to go 7 levels further down to find out how I can put, I don't know, the heated seats on. Let's name that. I'm really dying to go down to 7 levels. So I don't see it. In fact, I see a lot of it swinging the other way. I think, you know, rightly or wrongly, I love this industry, but this industry is predicated on imitation. So someone says, this shall be the screen to rule all the screens, and then away it goes, and the screens get bigger and more stuff gets chucked into the screen. Everyone goes flying down the rabbit hole, and away you go, and then the chance you have to look up. As you know, the car business has a lot of things that have worked well. So what allows us to do it? I think the first thing, Scout has to play a little bit to its legacy and a sense of mechanicalism, if you will. That's the first thing. I think the second thing, if you look at a lot of trends in America, without a doubt, Americans want to do things again, do things with their hands, whether it's gardening or whether it's hiking, whatever it might be. And I think they want that in their car. I think there's an uneasiness that says all will be handled. AI, software, program, don't worry about anything. It's all getting taken care of. I think people want to see, I flick the switch. And again, you see this with kitchens, right? It was a whole big thing that said, okay, I'll have all this software and I'll pre-program the microwave. I'll time my oven. I'll come home at 6 o'clock and da-da. And now everything's swinging back to these, like, robust, mechanical, boom. So I think the trend's there. I definitely think it's there for Scout, because that's the kind of brand we are. And clinic after clinics told us, yeah, I want to do some stuff myself. Software has magical, magical, powerful things, but there's things mechanics do quite well as well. So I'm with you, and it's not for every brand, full stop. I think there's some brands, exactly as you laid it out, is right. For Scout, I would say no, because it's in our very name. You know, Scouts go out there, they go out there first, they count on the land, they count on themselves, they count on their intuition. And we want to give them a tool to do that. And the tool is not just software. The tool is definitely mechanical.
This leads perfectly to my question. So, Ed, you somehow teed me up. So thank you. Earlier,
you arranged talked it, about, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah, because we have so many meetings.
These are all
meetings. So you call Scout an RUV. I promise you I'll never use that acronym, but you guys
can. I know. Yeah, thank you. But, we'll try.
but the ruggedness is an important point. And just now you also mentioned how there is some copycatting in the industry. And one of those we've found has been around manufacturing, the gigacasting movement. And what has happened there is the trade-off is oftentimes very expensive repairs. So I'm wondering what Scout's going to do around manufacturing strategy to make something that is really, truly rugged and doesn't cost $80,000 to repair if you get in a minor fender bender, which has been a problem with other EV companies, right? So what's the strategy and thinking? Are you going to go the route of the gigacasting route or take some other, more traditional manufacturing strategy?
Yeah, I think two things there. First, good question. I think if, you know, first and foremost, every plant and every operation, you want to build a truck as efficiently as possible. Yeah, so you want to have the least amount of time, least amount of cost as the car comes down the line. No debate. The second thing, which I think goes to your point for Scout, is we want to build 100% a very robust vehicle. So we're probably going to err more on the side of more labor in the factory versus automating everything. It gives us a lot of flexibility if you do it that way. I think the second thing, if you take a look at this with the ramp up that we have, entirely new company, entirely new greenfield factory, entirely new vehicle. There's only so many variables we want to be moving at one time. So no, while we'll look for optimization across the board, we don't see the heavy gigacasting that some of the examples that you've given already applying to Scout. I think it's going to be more straightforward. It's going to be more robust. But the upside of a greenfield plant is that logistics-wise and everything else, we can lay it out quite well, and we will lay it out quite well. But I don't see that for the type of vehicle we're building. Plus, I think, as you said, cost of ownership is critical to this group. We're obviously, you know, we keep using the fact of we're giving them a tool, and a tool is something they're going to need, and they're going to need, and they're going to use, and cost is a big factor, not just the purchase, but the life cycle cost.
So just to follow up, so you're looking for efficiencies more in how the assembly line is laid out and logistically how the plant is laid out, and less so maybe on the specific manufacturing technology you're automating. Is that fair?
Yeah. And again, I don't want to give the impression we're going back to the 1930s in terms of manufacturing the plant. Sure. It will be a super efficient plant. But you asked a specific question on gigacasting. And for this type of vehicle, I don't see it.
What's the retail plan?
Look, we haven't announced our retail plan, so you'll be the first to know, Alex, when we do announce. It's obviously question.
Alex is going to be the first to know. All right.
Well, I live in Arizona, so I'm curious because I could, you know, go on, Scott.
Yeah, Alex, trying to get yourself an invitation on something?
A franchise?
What are you leveraging?
Are we in franchise negotiations all of a sudden?
Yeah.
So, no, look, there's a lot going on in this area, as you know, and we will announce when our strategy is ready. Right now, we're focused on the company, focused on the product, focused on the factory, and obviously, we want to do what's right for the customer, and we will do what's right for the customer, but nothing to announce now in terms of our retail strategy.
So when I was snooping around the International Harvester Scout Wiki, there was a line at the end of it about their 1980 product plan roadmap before shutdown. Do you know the line I'm talking about?
Let me
pull it up.
I've seen the sketches for the Scout 3, but of course it never made it. But
they had plans for trailers, a luxury SUV, camper vans, RVs, like they had a whole thing, which sounded quite cool. I'm a fan of the, what you call it, Microlino, the little electric resto mod. Ed, what's that thing called that was based on? The Messerschmitt.
You mean the Swiss brand that used the Scout platform?
No, there was a three wheel thing made by BMW back in the day.
The Isetta,
there was the Isetta trailer. And so, this whole time, like, you know, there is a parallel universe of cooler, better, different stuff that we never got. You're nodding. Do you want to say words to that?
I don't want to give the impression we're coming in with the three wheel vehicle. So I definitely don't want to give that impression. But I think what you said that was quite cool about Scout, and something obviously we're continuing to look at, is all of the individualization and modifications, everything else I did. So I think the first thing, absolute drop dead given, is we are going to have, you know, a massive amount of super cool accessories, either ones we design ourselves, or certainly ones we partner with. That'll check the box done. But I think you're right. The Scout brand gives you a lot of leeway for building more cars of character as opposed to just, you know, sort of another car on the road type of stuff. So we're looking at everything, But what I don't want to do is, of course, get lost in the weeds of a product plan and not deliver the two vehicles we want to deliver really well. So that's what we're laser focused on. But believe me, there's a lot of, let's say, playground in the Scout brand, full stop.
I have one more question, the kind of question that Kirsten would ask. So Kirsten, if you don't mind. All right, so you're a
This is a loaded question.
A wholly owned
I have no idea what's coming.
Wholly owned subsidiary of Volkswagen Group. If you are so independent, does that mean, is the door open to raising money from third parties, a potential IPO? Like, where's your head?
The door is open. So we've structured the company that we could take outside investors, we could take strategic partners, or potentially down the road go public. So the door is open. We've structured it that way. Nothing to announce, nothing to say just yet. But it's certainly an option on the table with how we set up the company, which is, I think, a good option to have big time.
So I have kind of a high level question that's a little related to what Alex is asking here, right? We're in an interesting moment for EV startups, right? Some might look at where you are at right now and say, hey, you know, there was this boom period for EV startups and the money was flowing thick and fast. And, you know, there's been some success there, and there's been some less than successful examples there. But, you know, certainly the environment has shifted from where it was sort of a few years ago. Some might say that is like a headwind, right? Others might say, you know, that has given you an opportunity to learn a lot from some folks. People spent, you know, spent billions of dollars making a lot of mistakes that you now have the opportunity to learn from and to try and avoid. I'm curious, what are your thoughts at a high level about sort of where you're at this moment? What are the challenges and the opportunities of being, leading an EV startup at this time? And how are you trying to avoid the mistakes that were very clearly made over the last, 10 years, give or take?
Yeah, look, I think both sides of the equation, the way you set up their question, are accurate and are right. And you would be super, super naive to sit here with rose-colored glasses on to say everything's going swimmingly and everything's going fantastic. Now, I'll then zero in on like the core issue. So core issue number one, do I believe in electrification? Do I believe in technology? Do I believe new technologies improve and get lower in cost? Yes, I do. Do I believe America is capable of delivering that? Yes. So if I look at the situation, I kind of like our position of bringing a vehicle in 27, because if I look at the core issues, core issue number one, which you guys have raised a number of times, obviously of cost. There's no way you can make an argument if American incomes have gone up 3-4% a year, let's say in that window, and then you have $90,000 EVs. There's only going to be so much room for a $90,000 EV, full stop. So I think that's there. And if I look at the cost opportunities from core technologies of batteries and everything else, it's improving. So that's good. I think the second one, without a doubt, and you've raised, and the solution's not on the table, I think everyone's banging their head on it, is infrastructure, no debate. But if I start to spread it out to the 27-30 window, you're going to have at least, let's be neutral on it, 10 times, let's say, the amount of chargers and infrastructure that's on the road today. So that is a good jump. More is needed. So I'm not saying it's perfect. The third one is what we discussed. You have to have a common standard. And whether it's NACS or whatever it is, but now it is NACS, that's fine. But that's going to go a long, long way. So I think those three pieces, and look, anyone who thinks any kind of major adoption is going to be linear, it never is. It's not like I'm going from Coke to Pepsi and I'm on a shelf and I'm at a 7-Eleven. It's like, oh, I'll try Pepsi, I'll try Coke. And you're just moving your hand on a shelf. Same price, same can, same everything. You have home charging, you have cost of charging, you have government incentives. How does it work? The adoption is much different. I view it like an S-curve, and I think you have a lot of S-curves in all sorts of industry, and this is one of those. There was a little bit of a moment where a little bit of a, as you say, a punch. That punch has been received, and how to react to that dynamic. But I'm a firm believer, as I said, in technology, firm believer in electrification. Even if you look at it globally, I think this concept of we're going to go back and hold our ears and pretend it's 1970s again, and this is going to be a nice, safe little place back in the 70s or back in the 80s, it's not going to be a safe place. It's going to be safe for a little bit of window. You're going to feel good. But then technology is going to keep going. Costs are going to keep coming down. Then all of a sudden, you're going to be behind. So that's how I see it. And yeah, that's sort of where we are.
The lightning 15-second answer question. Scott, do you drive a truck now? And if not, what was the last truck you owned?
Well, right now, actually, I have a Scout 2, which is on its way. So I'll consider that. I'll consider the last truck. I drove it through North South Carolina, put it through its test. I, by the way, loved driving an old school manual transmission again. And by the way, the car didn't have a single screen. I don't think it had any software that I'm aware of. And it was a total joy. So that's the last one. Right now, I'm not currently in a truck. But of course, we have Rivians here. We have Lightnings here. So I spent a lot of time in a Broncos here. At our engineering facility. So I spent a lot of time cycling in and out of those vehicles on and off road.
That was the right answer, Scott. My friends, thank you
for
another wonderful episode of the Autonocast.
My pleasure. Thanks, everybody. Absolute pleasure.